Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what happens when you pay state lawmakers more money or no money at all? And a new Netflix docuseries brings up perennial controversies in the polygamist enclaves of Colorado City, Arizona. But first, it is the end of the school year and lots of high school graduates are looking forward to college next year and figuring out how they're going to pay for it. One important step in doing this is filling out the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA. It's been a long uphill battle, though, to get more high school graduates to fill it out. Well, some good news on that front this year. Those FAFSA completion rates are going up, way up, here in Arizona by almost 20%, and they could get even higher. There are lots of reasons why, and here to tell us more is Bill DeBon, Senior Director of Data and Strategic Initiatives at the National College Attainment Network. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. So, Arizona's FAFSA completion rates are way up, like I said, 20%-ish. Talk about that context, though. Like, how do we stack up still to the rest of the country?
So Arizona has had one of the strongest bounce-back performances in terms of the number of FAFSAs completed statewide for the class of 2026. That's really encouraging. In terms of the overall percent of seniors completing, though, still have some room to grow. Around 41.5% of seniors have completed a FAFSA for the class of 2026, and that's running about 14 percentage points behind the national average. So still some room to make up there.
Okay. All right. I want to back up for a moment, Bill, and just talk about why it's hard to get people to complete the FAFSA. Like, it seems simple enough. Like, this is a way to get the federal government to maybe help you pay for college. Why don't all the students fill it out?
Well, there's all kinds of reasons. I would say that filing the FAFSA has gotten a lot easier over the past year or two. We have a speedier, smoother, simpler process. But, you know, students don't always have a clear vision for what they want to do after crossing the high school graduation stage. Sometimes they're worried about affordability. And in some cases, they, you know, are nervous about filling out what they see as a complicated form and could just benefit from a little bit of assistance doing so.
Yeah. I know there's also some reporting out there about some students who are from kind of mixed immigration status families who are basically afraid to fill it out, like afraid to give the federal government their information. How does the federal government use students' information here? Like, should they be concerned?
Well, so data submitted through the FAFSA is only supposed to be used to determine and award federal financial aid. But, you know, NCAN cannot guarantee mixed data students and families that data submitted as part of the FAFSA process will continue to be protected. And so what we've been advising students, families, the field, in terms of advising students whose parents may not have a Social Security number, is to advise them on a case-by-case basis about the risks and benefits of submitting a FAFSA. Mm-hmm. It is true there is a little bit of risk if the data aren't used and protected properly. On the other hand, completing the FAFSA is the only way to get access to federal financial aid, which is really important for college affordability.
Yeah, tricky situation. Okay, so the last time I think we talked about the FAFSA on the show was a few years ago when the federal government had rolled out a sort of overhauled, supposedly simplified new FAFSA form, right? And it was kind of a mess. It was delayed. There were glitches. People were very frustrated. Has the process gotten better? Is that part of why we're seeing these rates go up a lot right now?
It sure has. Yeah. The class 2024 rollout, a mess, I think would still be a generous way of describing it. But now for the class of 2026, right, we have seen record high high school senior FAFSA completion rates nationwide. We are setting a new record basically every week now.
Wow.
And that's good, not just for FAFSA completion's sake, but also because it represents students getting connected with financial aid that can help them pay for education and training after high school.
Yeah. I know that here in Arizona, the Arizona Board of Regents, the Department of Education have really pushed to try to get these completion rates up. Do you know what's working here and around the country?
So yeah, Arizona has a really great FAFSA completion ecosystem. You've got the Board of Regents, Department of Education, nonprofits like Education Forward Arizona pulling together. And so, there's a couple of different things we can point to. They had a 50 by fall initiative, which was challenging high schools to either reach a 50% FAFSA completion rate by New Year's or to increase their FAFSA completion rate. They revitalized the College Goal Sunday campaign, so there were statewide FAFSA Saturday events and kind of coordinated workshop dates. And so the idea here is that when students and families want or need assistance, either completing the FAFSA or exploring pathways after high school, that there are events, experts, programming out there that they can reach out to and get some support from.
There are some states, Bill, where there are policies, basically laws about this, right? What do those states look like? How many students will complete this form there?
So we call these policies universal FAFSA policies, where completing the FAFSA becomes either a requirement for students or the district, as part of high school graduation. And there are 9 states nationwide now that require this in some form or fashion. We see states with universal FAFSA policies getting a big boost up the FAFSA completion leaderboard. Something like 4 out of the top 5 states, 6 out of the top 10, and 8 of the top 15 all have some kind of FAFSA completion requirement.
Wow. Okay. Last 30 seconds for a very important question here, Bill. What's the impact of this? Like, as we see these completion rates go up, will we see more kids go to college? Will we still see more kids from low-income families go to college?
Historically, there's been a very tight association between FAFSA completion and immediate college enrollment. And when I say college here, I mean both education and training, a wide variety of pathways after high school graduation. And so, yeah, when we see more students complete the FAFSA, especially for students from low-income backgrounds, that means they are unlocking federal financial aid that makes these pathways more affordable and hopefully helps these students pursue the pathways, the careers that they are most interested in.
All right. Bill DeBon, Senior Director of Data and Strategic Initiatives at the National College Attainment Network, joining us. Bill, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
This session at the state capitol, lawmakers have attempted to tackle an issue that's always been a bit of a tough political sell, giving themselves a raise. Many of them argue their salary of $24,000 a year is just not enough to live on. We've seen several lawmakers leave of late, citing low pay as one of the reasons. But as Governor Katie Hobbs pointed out, it's intended to be a part-time salary. The session is supposed to last just 4 months, though that hasn't happened in years. Now, legislators have a host of ideas about how to increase their pay. Maybe it's a 30% of what members of Congress are paid. Maybe it's a bump to $35,000 a year. Maybe it should be $48,000 a year. Maybe it should be 60% of what the governor makes. None of those proposals has made it all the way through the legislative process at this point, but that is not the case in our neighboring state of New Mexico. There, lawmakers at the so-called Roundhouse in Santa Fe narrowly approved a proposal to not just raise lawmaker pay, but to pay them at all. That's because New Mexico is the only state legislature in the country where lawmakers get no salary. Zero. Nilch. But that could be about to change if voters approve this measure. I spoke more about it with the Albuquerque Journal's Capitol Bureau Chief, Dan Boyd.
Well, it's actually in New Mexico's constitution that, legislators should not be paid a salary. That said, it has been an issue that's come up in recent years. There's been proposals to pay legislators a salary, and they have increased kind of the per diem amount that they are paid, which is intended to cover lodging and food expenses. They also can qualify for a legislative pension plan, but this idea of actually paying legislators a salary has been kicking around for a few years, but finally kind of got across the finish line at the Roundhouse this year, and it's headed to voters in November.
Yeah. So let's talk about what that proposal looks like, because it's a pretty big deal, it sounds like, that voters are going to get to decide on this. In the past, voters there have not been so favorable to this idea, though, of paying their lawmakers. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, I've done some research, and it's been years since it's actually gone before voters. So I think everyone's curious here, kind of what voters' view on this year's proposal is going to be. But this would be setting legislative salaries at, aligning them with the median household income in New Mexico, which Currently is about $64,000 is the projection. Obviously, that could increase in future years based on inflation, but that would actually be higher than the average legislative pay for nationwide. So to go from not having any salary to kind of above the national average would be a big jump. And I think there's a lot of questions on how that might really change the nature of the legislature here.
Right. So let's talk about that, because having an unpaid legislature has, it seems to have shaped the way that the session works there, right? Like, it sounds like they're pretty quick. People are supposed to
Yes.
have other jobs, other careers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, historically, it's been a citizen legislature in New Mexico with the idea that, there's farmers, there's ranchers, there's teachers, folks from all different walks of life, and they come to the Capitol for 60 days in odd numbered years, 30 days in even numbered years. They pass a budget, they pass some other bills, but then they leave and they're kind of done for the year. Obviously, the governor can call them back for special sessions if there's an emergency, but that's kind of the way things have worked here for a number of years. And I really think that this, if approved by voters, could change that. There could be more of an appetite for longer sessions, and maybe a more powerful legislature instead of deferring a lot of power to the executive branch.
Right. So having a short session like that with this citizen legislature does seem to probably give the governor more power than it might in another state where the legislature is in session much longer or all year.
Yeah, I think we saw that during the pandemic, that the legislature just wasn't in session for a lot of it. And so it fell on the governor to issue a lot of public health orders, emergency funding, things like that. And it did raise some questions about kind of how much authority the governor should have. But ultimately, the legislature kind of didn't insert itself into some of that. And now with this proposal, I think that dynamic could be changing.
Yeah. So let's talk about who's behind this proposal, because it seems to have to do with who's representing the state today. Like, many lawmakers have left, and we've seen this happen in Arizona as well, where they say, I simply can't afford to do this. I don't have a job where I can take 30 or 60 days off every year and make enough money to support my family.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen several legislators here for exactly those reasons step down and just say, I can't make this work financially. I have a family. I need to make ends meet and pay the bills. And so we have seen New Mexico's legislature in recent years increasingly, becoming a more heavily female. We now have a House of Representatives here that's a female majority. The overall legislature is a female majority, one of the few states. And really, this push to pay legislators a salary has been led by female legislators, and specifically in this year's session, it was some younger women who were recently elected who really led the push and just said, the legislature needs to be more reflective of the state as a whole, and kind of by doing this, it would allow some folks right now who can't serve in the legislature the chance to at least consider doing that.
That's interesting. I mean, what does the other side say here? Like, has there been pushback to this proposal? I know it was a party line vote, but it's a Democratic majority legislature, right? I mean,
Yes.
what those who are against it, what do they argue?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they argue that, some people might then get into it for the wrong reasons, for personal enrichment rather than kind of the good of the state. Interestingly, even the governor, who's a Democrat, Michelle Lujan Grisham, she said she had kind of mixed feelings about it, that it could change and make the legislature feel a bit more like Congress, and maybe some of that access and things like that would change. But she also said, that maybe it would get some folks to run for the legislature who would be good fits and who would bring some assets to the table, who haven't been able to do so for financial reasons in the past. So even some people like that who may have kind of mixed feelings about this proposal.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think we've seen a similar debate here from lawmakers who say, sort of, if you don't pay people like a living wage and expect them to be lawmakers for even part of the year, I mean, you're going to get a lot of maybe independently wealthy people, maybe retirees, things like that. Is that what you've seen there as well?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And obviously, some professions that may be easier to take 60 or 30 days off a year. There's a number of lawyers, here in the New Mexico legislature, but also a lot of retirees. There's not as many. There's, I think, one current teacher. I don't think there's any doctors still currently in the New Mexico legislature. So I think this idea of a citizen legislature, may be kind of rooted in the past a little bit, and it's kind of arguable how accurate it still is, at this point.
It's interesting. So, I mean, as we mentioned, this has not been a super popular idea with voters in the past. And it is sort of a hard political sell, right? Because especially right now, like, prices are so high, people are grappling with cost of living issues. Do you think voters will be supportive of paying legislators right now when lots of people can't make ends meet?
Yeah, I haven't seen any polling yet, but I think those factors you mentioned, especially with the gas prices we're seeing in recent months, I think there will be some skepticism. And I think it'll be incumbent on supporters of this idea to really try to lay out an argument of, of why this is justified. I think the fact that in past years, even though it's been a number of years ago, that these type of proposals have failed when they've gone to voters is kind of a sign that it is a tough sell politically. And even here in New Mexico, there had been previous proposals to set up an outside commission to pay legislators, different kind of formats. And they settled this year on this model of tying it to the median household income. So I think it is just politically awkward for legislators to, to vote on a pay raise for themselves.
Always is. All right. Well, lots to watch for coming out of New Mexico. That is Dan Boyd, the Albuquerque Journal's Capital Bureau Chief, joining us from Santa Fe. Dan, thank you so much for coming on. Interesting stuff.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the new self-proclaimed prophet of Warren Jeffs' fundamentalist Mormon offshoot is at the center of a new Netflix documentary.
When Warren Jeffs went to prison, Sam began to amass followers. Over time, he began to tell the people that believed in him that he was a new prophet. There were about 50 people from three separate families who became acolytes and followers.
We'll hear from the documentary's executive producer. But first, a Tucson-based news outlet spent several months asking its community what they wanted to read about and what issues they thought were important. Among the results, more coverage of housing and homelessness, roads and infrastructure and immigration. And readers said they want solutions-based reporting. Caitlin Schmidt is co-founder, editor, and publisher of Tucson Spotlight, which conducted the survey with the help of a grant. She spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, about the findings, and they started with what the thought process was behind asking the community what it wanted, what it didn't want, what they were thinking.
Yeah, so back in, I want to say 2020, when I was working at the Arizona Daily Star, I created a solutions journalism beat there and launched it with basically a listening session project similar to this. And we surveyed people around the community, trying to get ideas of stories, trying to get ideas of, problems that they wanted to learn more about solutions to, et cetera, et cetera. And that went really well. And it was very helpful in guiding how we set up that beat and what we did with it. So after we launched Tucson Spotlight and I heard about this grant, it seemed like a great opportunity to really build our newsroom around what the community said that they wanted and needed.
Well, so what did the community say they wanted and needed?
Yes, they wanted more news and better news. The biggest complaint that we had from people about, why they maybe weren't accessing the news was that it made them feel hopeless. And it was too negative skewing. So very quickly, we started getting those answers like in the first round of surveying. And so we very quickly adjusted our editorial strategy to ensure that we were never running just only hard news stories on a single day. So we would always couple a hard news story with either a solutions piece or a news feature or a story about somebody doing some good in the community. So it was a good way to kind of build our processes and teach our team, really what folks felt like they weren't getting. And people responded very favorably to that. So that was, I think, our first big takeaway was, it's not that people didn't want to consume the news or that they were driven away by paywalls. They were driven away by the content because it just felt too dark. And I think we all in the news industry, it feels like we're drinking from a fire hose every day. And so yeah, we don't want our audience feeling that way, too.
Well, so how do you try to balance that between the news that, the hard news, which, can be a little bit unsettling or upsetting or depressing, but, is also important for readers to know versus the stuff that will, make them feel good?
Yeah, and that's the beauty, I think, of solutions reporting is that it's not fluff. They're not puff pieces. They're not it's not junk news. It's, you know, deep investigative reporting about the responses to social problems. So people are learning as they're consuming the news. They're getting the information that they need about the problem, but they aren't getting, you know, beat over the head with it over and over again. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to some of these problems like homelessness and climate change, I mean, I think everybody knows that's an issue. But what they don't know is what people are doing to try to address it in different parts of the community.
Were you surprised at how often the issue of housing and homelessness came up?
You know, I really was not. I think, you know, it's for anybody that covers local government or follows local government or, you know, state or federal government. I mean, I think that issue is at top of mind right now. We have a growing population of unhoused people, and it's not the people that we used to see be unhoused. It's people who are a paycheck away from losing their homes or being evicted. So I wasn't surprised, but I was surprised to see that really, it transcended demographics. Like every age group, every group that we talked to, homelessness was the top answer. So I think it just shows how widespread of a concern that is in our community.
Yeah, I want to know if you think that sort of speaks to maybe the concern that people have, or at least the awareness that people have about what a big issue that is.
I think so, definitely. I mean, you can't ignore it if you're out in public. It's a reality that's on many street corners in the community. And when you're confronted with it in your face every day, I think people really have a desire to know what the people that they elected into office, that we're paying taxes to, what, you know, what they're doing to solve these problems.
I'm particularly interested in what people told you about their use of social media for getting news, in the sense that it wasn't necessarily because they thought it was the best source, but it was almost just like the easiest place to find it.
Yeah, I mean, and yes, definitely. And that also kind of transcended generations too. The social media users weren't just, you know, confined to the younger generation. We had people of all ages answering that question. I mean, I think part of it is ease of access, right? If you're going on Instagram or Facebook or TikTok to check in on your friends and family, why not follow some news outlets too and get some news while you're at it? I think, you know, everybody's getting news on social media, whether or not you want it. Even if you don't follow news outlets, somebody in your feed is probably sharing it. So we have always been really social media forward from the start at Tucson Spotlight. We are just very aware that there are people that are never going to watch a TV news piece, or they're never going to go to TucsonSpotlight.org or pick up a newspaper. And so we want to make sure that they have access to the information that they need to know that is fact-based and accurate.
Yeah. So how do you expect that the results of this survey will inform what you do going forward and how you do it?
Yes. I mean, so one of the questions that we had asked people was, you know, what were problems that they wanted to learn more about? And so we definitely will invest more resources and more staff into some of those topics. But we also got a really great list of story ideas. One of the questions that we asked was, you know, who do you know that's doing great work in the community? And we have a great list of groups and individual people so that we can, you know, shape some coverage around. And I will say, people, you know, as we've gotten these story ideas and we've produced the stories and we've shared them back with the person or the people that give us the idea, they're usually very grateful. You know, it's nice to know that when you're talking to someone, they're actually listening and maybe we'll do something about it.
All right. That is Caitlin Schmidt, co-founder, editor, and publisher of Tucson Spotlight. Caitlin, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Warmer water in rivers and streams may have big consequences for those waterways, as well as the ecosystems around them. That's among the findings of new research published in the journal Ecosphere. Michael Zampini is a postdoctoral researcher at UC Berkeley and did his PhD at Northern Arizona University. This study was part of that work done in Flagstaff. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about it, and they started with a thumbnail version of what he was trying to figure out with this research.
Perfect. Yeah. So at its core, this study is about how rivers process leaves. And so in a lot of streams and rivers, especially forested ones, leaves that fall in from trees are actually the main source of energy. So we wanted to understand how warming changes the way that energy moves through this system, and particularly how does that energy move up to higher trophic levels like fish and things like that.
And what would finding that out tell you? Like, why is that important to know?
Yeah, so it might not be super exciting at first, but it's really like fundamental. So leaves that are broken down by microbes are then eaten by aquatic insects, and then those insects are a major food source for fish. So when you change how leaf litter is processed in rivers, you're really changing the entire food web of that whole system. So that's sort of a why should we care kind of a importance thing.
It kind of moves up the food chain, as it were.
Right, yeah. So the thing, most of the things people care about in rivers are, the fish inside them. And actually, people probably don't think about this very often, but aquatic insects spend some portion of their lives in the river, but then they emerge out and turn into kind of their mature stage, which is like flies and other flying insects that end up making food for birds and spiders and kind of like the terrestrial environment, or basically the forest that surrounds the river. So rivers kind of like pump out a ton of important prey for the biology surrounding them.
Well, and you found that as the temperature of the water in these streams rises, it is having a change, right? It is causing a change in how all this works.
Yeah, exactly. So warming definitely speeds things up. So decomposition of the leaves and twigs and sticks, that all happens faster, but it also changes how efficiently the system works. So what we found is that more of the carbon gets lost as CO2, and less of it gets turned into biomass that ends up supporting that river food web.
So, what kind of implications might that have?
Really, for implications, it's like if temperatures keep rising, we might push our insects out of their kind of thermal optimal range. So that means that they'll still probably be active, but they're not really using that energy as efficiently, and less of it makes its way up the food web. So you might have smaller aquatic insect kind of population sizes, and that sort of diminishes the food base of the river for higher trophic levels like fish.
And as you were saying, that could also have effects sort of downstream, again, pardon the pun, in terms of things that happen on land.
Yeah, so I think it's sort of especially relevant for rivers in the Southwest, where our rivers are already relatively warm. And that means that they're kind of already close to this optimal range that we found in this study. So even small increases in river temperatures could kind of push them beyond that threshold, and we might start to see realized effects of how the systems might function differently.
What kind of temperature change are we seeing? Like, are streams and rivers actually getting noticeably warmer?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So stream temperature and air temperature, it's not like they increase together exactly. So air temperatures are increasing faster than just like the baseline river temperatures are. But river temperatures are actually a lot more variable than air temperature. So in a year like this year we just had, where we didn't get a lot of snowfall in the mountains of the West, then we're going to have really a lot slower moving rivers as the summer progresses this year. And it's really that change in flow that's going to change river temperatures probably more. So the more variability we have in things like precipitation, or when we have droughts, that's when you have really big changes in river temperature, and mostly for the warmer in that case.
Is there something to be said also in terms of whether or not there's a lot of precipitation that can impact how much foliage there is, like how many leaves and twigs fall into a river or stream in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. So in droughts, it can be kind of a double effect, right? Where you have warmer river temperatures because the air temperature is warmer, and we're also not getting a lot of flow through the river. And then in those same years, you might have a decrease in sort of tree growth or productivity by the forest surrounding the river. And that'll result in less food going into the river. And food in this case is that leaf litter that drives the energy base of rivers.
Do you know why this is happening in terms of why rising water temperatures sort of speeds up some of this decomposition?
Well, yeah, it works sort of similarly to like a gas guzzling car. So you can have the system kind of moving faster, but you end up having, less efficiency at that higher temperature. So So what tends to happen is organisms have this sort of like baseline need of energy that you call it their like kind of like maintenance requirements. And the higher the temperatures go, the higher those that maintenance cost gets. So then they're not able to pack on as much biomass from what they're eating. So basically it's like the price of the house goes up, so they're not able to buy the boat in the front yard or go on a vacation or something like that.
Huh. Well, can you foresee a time where if, for example, the temperature of these rivers and streams gets too high, that it could have a real noticeable change in sort of the ecosystem in terms of what is able to live in it and live around it?
Well, yeah, definitely. Ecosystems operate in these kind of alternative states. So a lot of times they are resilient up to a point or up to a threshold. And then once that threshold is met, then they can flip to a totally different state. And there's a ton of studies that have kind of highlighted this interest in thresholds. And yeah, what my study shows is that our aquatic insects are kind of right up at that threshold. So with kind of modest increases in river temperatures beyond what we're already seeing, we might flip that threshold.
All right. That is Michael Zampini, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. Michael, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
School is out for summer, or will be soon for kids across the valley. It's hardly a stress-free time, and we're not just talking about the heat. Some families have been making vacation plans since January. Summer camp can be as expensive as college, with waiting lists just as long. But for many kids, summer doesn't hold the magic of canoeing on a lake or visiting Disneyland. Tim Daly is the author of the Substack, The Education Daily. I spoke with him last summer about the paradox of summer vacation for kids and its growing inequality.
It's a persistent myth that summer vacation is scheduled so kids could work on farms. And in reality, it was quite the opposite. It started because East Coast cities were crowded and hot in the summer, and families that had the money to do so wanted to leave the city and take their kids to seaside destinations. Huh. And so that was the origin of summer vacation. It wasn't about farming kids at all.
Right. Okay. So you say progressive educators said, you know, this isn't fair. We need to let kids who aren't rich basically play outside in the summer as well. And the summer break is born.
That's exactly right. And it was kind of the intent was to give all kids the same experience, so to speak, that rich kids had.
Interesting. But you argue that that's never been the case, that rich kids have always had the upper hand when it comes to summer, and in lots of ways kind of been the only ones who benefit from it.
That's right. It's never worked for families that don't have means, because parents are frequently working, and activities cost a lot of money. Vacations cost a lot of money. And so for the most part, sleepaway summer camps and other great opportunities that we often associate with summer vacation, those are largely available to upper middle class and wealthy families, and pretty inaccessible to lower income families.
Yeah. So I want to talk more about that in a moment, but let me back you up for just a second and talk about the trade-off in summer breaks, right? Like, is it mm-hmm. worth it? Do we have any data on whether or not we should even have summer breaks if kids are losing too much in progress in mm-hmm. education in that time?
Mm. It's a really interesting question, because kids do lose some ground academically. Some kids can afford to lose a little bit of ground because they're in really good shape. So they lose a bit in the summer, they gain a bunch of really interesting experiences, and then they come back in the fall, and pretty quickly they make up the ground that they lost. It's a more difficult question for kids who are behind, because there is really good research suggesting that when students are academically behind and they participate in high quality summer programming, it's a great way to catch up. So I think it's fair to describe summer as a trade-off. And you could argue that getting to participate in summer jobs and cultural experiences like going to museums and maybe doing sleepaway camp make it worthwhile. But it's most worthwhile for kids who are academically in pretty good shape and who don't need summer to catch up.
Right. You mentioned summer jobs, and I want to pause there for a moment because mm-hmm. you point out something really interesting in your piece that surprised me about summer jobs, that you assume that kids who don't have as much money are the ones working summer jobs, but you said that's actually the opposite.
That's exactly right. Kids who are most likely to have employment during the summer are wealthy kids because they're the ones who are able to, for example, have transportation to where their employment takes place. And jobs also require things like recommendations and resumes and things like that. And teen employment has been dropping for decades. So teens today are much less likely to work during the summer or the school year than kids a few decades ago.
Interesting. So let's talk then about what this looks like for those kids who aren't from wealthy families. Like, what do they end up doing with their summers?
They spend an enormous amount of time on screens. That's a pattern that's emerged over the last 10 or 15 years. We talk a lot about the concern with rising screen time for children and adolescents, and it's very much tilted. Lower income kids spend much more time on screens than higher income kids. And in the summer, the least expensive activity is to just be inside and either on a computer or a tablet or a phone or watching TV. So I think the number one thing is lots of screen time.
It's interesting because here in Arizona, I mean, summers are incredibly hot, right? So,
I mean,
you can't even let kids go outside and play in the way that, you know, you might not be able to let kids go outside and play in the winter on the East Coast.
Right.
And lots of cities are getting hotter. Like, it's becoming less safe for kids to play outside all the time, whether or not they're in the middle of the desert like we are. Do you think that could make summers less enriching for kids who aren't rich going forward?
Yes, absolutely could make a difference. And I think the kinds of summer activities that are positive are typically structured and they're social. So it's not, you know, kids inside by themselves. It's groups of kids playing team sports together, taking trips together. Those sorts of things are really rewarding. And to the degree that extreme heat makes it harder for families to do anything but just keep their kids inside, I think that probably is a risk factor going forward.
And we should mention at the same time, the price of formulating a summer plan for your kids has just shot up, right? Like whether it's, you know, expensive travel, but even just day camps.
That's right. And it's over the last couple of decades, wealthier parents have just poured more and more money into their kids in many different forms. They pay lots of money for academic enrichment. They pay for their kids to play on travel sports teams, and they pay more money for things like summer camps. So the gap between the haves and the have-nots when it comes to summer has only gotten bigger because there is this market out there for really expensive summer activities that are out of the reach of most families.
All right. So then let's talk about solutions, potential solutions, which you have some ideas for, whether it's subsidizing programs that wealthy kids get to do and letting other kids go to them as well, job programs, scholarships, et cetera. What are some of the ideas on the table?
We absolutely should have more employment opportunities for kids beginning at age 13, 14, 15. And some cities are investing in that. The research has shown that when kids are employed during the summer, not only do they earn more money, but they seem to pick up habits that make it less likely for them to be chronically absent from school the next year and less likely to drop out. One thing to think about is how to subsidize local employers to take on more teen employees for those short-term summer months. That can be done in lots of different ways, but I think one objective certainly should be more kids in the workforce.
Okay. You also drop the V word. What are summer vouchers?
So in the new federal bill that was passed this summer, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, there is a substantial federal subsidy for education scholarships, so essentially vouchers. And states have to choose to participate in that program. Some states will probably choose to do it and some states won't. It's a little bit different than state-level vouchers because this would be all federal money. And an open question is whether states could choose to use those vouchers specifically for summer programming. So there are certainly states that are unlikely to adopt traditional vouchers, generally blue states like New York or California or Illinois. They're probably not going to be interested in participating in a traditional private school subsidy program. But it's not clear right now that they couldn't elect to accept those vouchers and restrict their use just for summer. And if they did that, they potentially could provide pretty lucrative vouchers worth several thousand dollars each to every family with school-aged children, that would almost instantly level the playing field in terms of affordability for summer activities.
That's Tim Daly, author of the Substack, The Education Daily, and this is the show. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Rachel Dretsen's follow-up Netflix documentary to Keep Sweet, Pray, Obey follows a couple as they capture footage of a new self-proclaimed prophet of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Samuel Bateman. Bateman is serving prison time now for sex crimes against his many underaged wives. He convinced them he was the new FLDS prophet after Warren Jeffs was put behind bars. In Trust Me, the False Prophet, cult expert Christine Marie and her filmmaker husband Tolga Kadas gain the trust of Bateman and his wives, nine of whom were minors, and capture evidence of his crimes against them. I spoke with Dretsen more about the new documentary. And a warning, this conversation may not be appropriate for all listeners.
The footage that's featured in most of the documentary was filmed by Christine Marie and Tolga Kadas, who are a married couple, who were among the only outsiders to move into Short Creek before, I would say, 2020. I mean, there were just very few people from outside of the community moving in. And not only did they move into the community full time, but they devoted themselves to building trust and friendship with people both in and out of the FLDS. And so they had a very rare opportunity in that they were able to engage in a meaningful way with people in a very, very close community that, generally speaking, doesn't open itself up to outsiders. Mm-hmm. And with Sam Bateman, they managed to get even deeper. And so it was just, you know, despite the fact that the FLDS has received a lot of coverage in the media, there's been very little footage that has the rawness and the intimacy of theirs.
So let's back up and just talk about Samuel Bateman and the kind of world that he created, the way that he convinced people that he was essentially the new prophet. Tell us a little bit about him. He's in prison now.
Sam is in prison for 50 years, which is essentially life because he's in his 50s. He grew up as a member, relatively low-level member of the FLDS, no particular notoriety. But, and he had interestingly, we don't get into this in the series, but he had a traumatic brain injury in a car accident he was in when he was much younger, which may have some impact on his somewhat delusional sort of mental state. But he, when Warren Jeffs went to prison, Sam began to amass followers. Initially, he did not say he was a new prophet. He made people think that he had special access to Warren in prison because Warren was still seen as a prophet. But then over time, he began to tell the people that believed in him that he was a new prophet, and that Warren, they have a term called translated, which essentially means someone is, you know, able to speak through you. And that's what he said Warren was doing. And there were about 50 people from three separate families who became acolytes and followers.
And he took on many wives, many of whom were underage and who, you know, were sexually abused, essentially.
Yeah. So there were three men, male followers of Sam, who had multiple wives and children, daughters. And part of their devotion involved giving their wives and daughters over to Sam. And so he gathered about over 20 wives, and nine of those were underage, some as young as 9 or 10 years old.
Right.
And yes, he was, it's come out in court documents what Sam was doing, which is just horrific, but involved sexual abuse of all of them on a daily basis.
Right. So you have released this new docuseries. This footage is out there. It sounds like you've talked to some of the women involved in it since and have tried to sort of prepare them for this because, you know, they're now the star of this Netflix series. What's that been like? What are those conversations like?
Well, it really depends on who the conversations are with. I mean, with Gnomes, who is the wife of Sam's, who participated most extensively in the documentary, we worked with her for some time to prepare her for what was to come because, you know, while we didn't know this series was going to land as hugely as it has, it is a big event in someone's life when overnight they're, you know, suddenly on Netflix around the world, and particularly for someone from the kind of background that Gnomes had. So we really worked with her. She had some counseling. We talked a lot. We talked to her about, you know, all sorts of things that, you know, would help her anticipate what the reaction would be. But of course, you know, you can't really anticipate it. I would say it's been a really positive experience for her. She was very isolated, still is very isolated in that community, but she's gotten such an outpouring of love and support from people all over the world that I think it's really buoyed her and made her feel even more strongly that she made the right decision in coming forward, which was not an easy decision. Julia, who is the mother of five of Sam's wives, is still a member of the FLDS. And so she's much less, you know, Gnomes has left the group, the church. Julia is still very much a part of it. And so she's much more sheltered from the media and from the impact that the series has had.
Mm-hmm.
I have had contact with her, really lovely contact with her, but for the most part, I think she wants to stay very private, which I respect.
Yeah. So some of the people involved in this have left the church or, you know, at least gotten out of the grips of Sam Bateman, but some are not. You said that some of them still talk to them today, even as he's in prison?
Yes, actually, the majority of the adult women, and by adult, I mean over 18, who were married to Sam are still, or at least as of the series being released, were still followers of Sam's, and many of them living together still. The nine minors who were married to Sam have all, because they were separated from the rest of the women, they all, quote unquote, woke up and testified against him and have, for the most part, been able to live successfully outside of the group.
Right.
But the adults are still very caught up in it.
So I want to ask you lastly, Rachel, about Short Creek, right? Because it's an interesting moment for this place, which is very interesting in itself. I know that I've interviewed folks in Short Creek who are trying really hard to move the town beyond the FLDS church, its crimes, its, you know, controversy. They're trying to rebrand as a tourist destination right now. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, most people, lots of people, at least in the town, are no longer members of the FLDS church. Have you spoken to folks there? I know you spent a lot of time there, like, who are worried about, you know, being dragged back into this?
Yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing issue and one that I really sympathize with. I mean, I think, you know, there's been so much media scrutiny of this tiny little community. And there were many years where there were just reporters, you know, driving through with cameras.
Yeah.
And they felt like animals in the zoo, you know. And I think it's very hard for the community to get out from under its reputation. That said, I really tried in this documentary to humanize these people in prairie dresses who we tend to look at as alien creatures. You know, I think that not only Julia, but several of the other women who are still members of the FLDS who participate in the documentary show just how different they are than the stereotypes that we put on them. And I hope that it contributes to a little bit more of a dimensional perspective on what it means to be a fundamentalist Mormon, you know, and a member of this community. But it's just it's a reality that there has been one horrific story after another coming out of this place. It's also gotten, I would say, Short Creek has gotten some really good coverage of some of the changes they've made. There was a terrific podcast about the town that came out a few years ago that really looked closely at some of the changes the town is making.
Mm-hmm.
That are very real, you know? So I empathize. I understand that it's a frustrating position to be in.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Rachel Dretson, the new film, is on Netflix. It's called Trust Me, The False Prophet. Rachel, thank you very much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.